Thanks for listening to Only a Game. If you love this show, then you may also love other great podcast shows and journalism brought to you by NPR. By supporting your local public radio station, you help us to serve and inform your community. Be informed. Be connected. Be a part of your public radio. Support public radio by visiting donate.npr.org/onlyagame. Then use the hashtag #YourPublicRadio to share why you support independent journalism. This is Only a Game. I'm Craig Calcaterra.
At the end of the day, when you're sitting reviewing your life, you have a lot of regrets as to how you could have done things better.
That could be almost anyone, but it's not. It's Bob Cousy. On the basketball court, it's hard to imagine how the Hall of Famer could have done much better. He was team captain for the first six Boston Celtics titles. But Cousy has been thinking a lot lately about his relationship with former teammate Bill Russell.
I felt some guilt over not reaching out to him, and that's what I did eventually.
Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
On a cold autumn morning, Bob Cousy greets me at the front door as the leaves fall around his home in Worcester, Massachusetts. He's lived there alone since his wife died 5 years ago. I shake his hand and ask him how he's doing. "Never ask a 90-year-old that question," he says. He brandishes his cane for emphasis. We sit at his enormous dining room table and talk about his early days on the Celtics. His hands move like he's throwing passes to invisible teammates as he discusses his rookie year.
"Well, we had some talented players. We had some not-so-talented players."
Cousy says that his fellow rookie, Chuck Cooper, was a 5 or 6 on a 10 scale, talent-wise. But Cooper was something else.
"Jackie Robinson broke the color line in baseball in 1947. 3 years later, our owner, Walter Brown, got up at the meeting and said, 'The Celtics draft Chuck Cooper from Duquesne.'"
Cousy had no black friends growing up in a Manhattan tenement. He had no black teammates in high school or college. Now he was roommates with the first black player selected in the NBA draft. They went to movies, listened to jazz, and drank at bars. Their bond was tested on February 28, 1952, after a game in Raleigh.
"And he wasn't allowed to register in a hotel with us. And Chuck and I somehow found out that there was a sleeper going through Raleigh that night at 12:30 to New York with a connection to Boston."
Cousy and Cooper went to Union Station to wait for the sleeper train.
"We start drinking beer, and after 3 or 4 beers, it's like midnight, and we have to go whiz."
They made their way to the restroom. Cousy was unprepared for what he saw.
"Stupid signs, big white signs with a black arrow, one pointing right says colored, the other pointing left says white. And I was stunned. I was ashamed to be white. I didn't know what to say to him. I said, 'Come on, let's go out.' We go out to the end of the platform and we peed together."
Their friendship grew off the court and on it. Cooper was a good player, but Cousy, a point guard, was beginning to transform the league.
This is the 1950s, and he's a little bit like Elvis Presley in music or James Dean in film.
That's writer Gary Pomerantz. He's interviewed Cousy over 50 times.
"He's a renegade, pushing out against the conservative norms, dribbling behind his back and throwing no-look passes. He was adding sort of a jolt of caffeine to the NBA, a jolt of style."
But the Celts were only slightly better than mediocre.
"They were a team struggling to find itself. The Celtics needed a big man to make it to the next level."
In a trade after the 1956 draft, the Celtics acquired center Bill Russell.
"Russ changed the dynamic in every way.
He was a fearsome shot blocker.
He put a trauma on opposing shooters.
And he was a great rebounder.
An opponent would take a shot and miss, and there's Russell rising, 6'10", long, lean, and springy, getting the rebound, and half-turning and snap-passing the outlet to Cousy.
Russell and Cousy created a fast-break style that was nearly indefensible.
These are, in many ways, the ultimate teammates. They were both murderously competitive. And very quickly, the Celtics emerged as a force to be reckoned with.
Russell and Cous had a relatively tight relationship on the court.
That's forward Satch Sanders. He joined the Celtics in 1960.
They had a lot of respect for each other. That was clear. off the court, they were not spending a lot of time in each other's company.
Racial tensions were high in the U.S. That carried over into some NBA locker rooms. But Sanders says that wasn't the case with the Celtics. Cousy says Red Auerbach, who he alone called by his first name, Arnold, created clubhouse harmony in a rather unusual way.
I think Arnold, frankly, solved the black-white situation pretty well. He treated everyone the same, badly. You know? So Russ and I's relationship was the same as any two people that are working towards a goal.
The goal was to win championships. And with Russell, the Celtics began to do that. But something else was happening at the outset of the Celtics dynasty. Gary Pomerantz.
Russell and Cousy were together for 7 years as teammates. And if you put that on the civil rights timeline, it's roughly from the end of the Montgomery bus boycott to Dr. King's March on Washington address in 1963. That is the heart of the black freedom struggle. And Russell would engage in that struggle in a way that few athletes did.
On October 17th, 1961, the Celtics played a preseason exhibition game in Lexington, Kentucky. Satch Sanders remembers what happened at the team hotel before the game.
We had gone downstairs to eat, and they said, well, we really can't serve you people.
They weren't happy about it, and they gathered in Russell's room of the hotel.
Russell and Sanders, along with Casey Jones and Sam Jones, decided not to play.
And Red didn't want to turn away from a nice payday for the team. So he tried to convince the African-American Celtics to stay. And Russell said, we're going home.
The white players gave it consideration, but in the end, they decided to play the game.
Seven white Celtics played, including Bob Cousy, who didn't protest.
I have no explanation for this feeling, as I do, about social justice, being the captain of the team.
When Gary Pomerantz originally asked Cousy about the game, he said he didn't remember it.
Cousy said, why did I play? What was I thinking? It was an exhibition game. Why didn't I say something? I think he was so focused on being Bob Cousy, some of the most essential American history of the second half of the century, passed him by, went over his head. He was focused on winning. He was focused on his endorsements and his brand. And it just went by.
Meanwhile, Bill Russell spoke more and more publicly about civil rights and the treatment of African Americans. He called Boston a racist city. The press went to Russell for quotes, but
they didn't like him because he exuded arrogance, confidence, and all the other things that black guys should not have in a lot of estimations.
In 1963, someone broke into Bill Russell's home, scrawled insults on the walls, and defecated in his bed. Russell wore his anger even more prominently on his sleeve.
Russ was the ultimate angry black man. And I didn't blame him then, and I blame him even less now.
Cousy says it pained him to watch African Americans struggle for acceptance and inclusion. But he remained quiet. And Cousy says Russell's anger made it hard for them to form a friendship like the ones Cousy had enjoyed with Chuck Cooper and some of his other black teammates.
Let's go have a beer, let's go to the movie together, whatever, we'll socialize outside of the unit. I was a senior member. I had a good relationship with the media, I always have. So I could have reached out and perhaps shared his pain a little bit with him, you know. I never did that with Russ.
Bob Cousy retired at the end of the 62-63 season, after yet another successful title run. He and Russell had led the Celtics to 6 NBA championships in their 7 seasons together. The Celtics gathered for a postseason dinner.
And Bill Russell took to the podium to speak. And what Russell said was, you meet very few men in life like Bob Cousy. I consider Cousy like a brother. And Russell became emotional at this point.
Cousy doesn't really remember that either.
Obviously, this should have been special to me. When I read what he said, it brought back a slight memory, and it brought a tear to my eye, but I don't know why I don't remember it more specifically, other than I'm 90 freaking years old. That's something to do with it, you know.
When I read these quotes to Cousy during an interview, Cousy just started shaking his head. He said, "What was I thinking? Why didn't I get up and go across the room and give Russ a hug?"
In the fall of 1963, the Celtics became Bill Russell's team, unless that had happened much earlier. Russell retired as a player in 1969. After 13 seasons in the NBA, he had earned 11 championship rings. Cousy did a lot of thinking over three decades about how he'd fallen short as a team leader. But he didn't talk about it until a 2001 ESPN interview about Russell.
And he was talking in a breezy way about Russell's extraordinary athleticism. But the topic shifted to race.
Well, I should have been much more sensitive to Russell's anguish in those days.
And he just broke down sobbing. He buried his head in his hands on camera.
A couple months later, Cousy attended a charity golf event in Florida. Russell, who had seen Cousy's ESPN interview, was there too, and Cousy had no idea what to expect.
Russ and I always said over the years, had kind of a love-hate relationship. And he'd either kind of ignore me or glare at me, or in this case, he ran over and threw his arms around me, and we talked about this first meaningful conversation we probably ever had in a relationship. And he basically said, "Coos, whatever you might have done wouldn't have been helpful." He said what he had to do to make me feel better, I guess. And I appreciated that.
And he hoped this conversation would lead to a higher ground in their relationship, a deeper friendship. But it really didn't.
I thought about it for 15 to 16 years, and I wrote him a letter 3 years ago, pretty much doing a mea culpa.
Cousy hand-wrote that letter.
And I basically said, "Russ, I know we've never been pen pals, and I'm sorry about that. It was my responsibility to reach out to you and hopefully share the pain that you had during that period, or minimize it, or whatever. However, I didn't do that. Sorry about that." And that was it.
Well, then 6 months passed without a response, and then a year, and then 2 years, and then 2.5 years later, in August of this year, 2018, Cousy got a call on a Sunday night at home. It was an old, somewhat enfeebled voice saying, "Bob, it's Bill Russell. I'm calling to see how you are." They talked for about 10 or 12 minutes, according to Cousy. And then he asked the question, "Russ, I sent you a letter a couple years ago. Did you get it?" And Bill Russell said, "Yes, I did. Thank you." Nothing more.
Was Russell's response brief because he was angry? Not angry at all? Cousy wouldn't speculate. I asked him if Bill Russell's simple response of yes was sufficient.
Yes, absolutely.
For 3 seasons, Satch Sanders observed the relationship between Bob Cousy and Bill Russell up close. I ask him if he thinks Cousy owed Russell an apology.
No, I don't think Cousy owed an apology. But I do think that Cousy, because he was Cousy, thought he could do more. And then started thinking that he should have done more. Because he's a man of conscience and sensitive. Could he have done more? Possibly. But he feels he could do more, and that's what really counts.
I do a lot of meditating these days, thinking about the old days, but I notice I blank out the negatives as much as I can, and I focus on the positives.
When our conversation is over, Bob Cousy shows me to the door. Audemer rushes in as he retrieves a plate of food a neighbor covered in tinfoil and left for him on the front step. I say goodbye and shake his hand, the one that threw so many perfect passes to his teammates, the one that held the pen as he wrote a letter to Bill Russell.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Gary Pomerantz's new book is The Last Pass, Cousy, Russell, the Celtics, and What Matters in the End. Coming up, the adults take a break from this whole interviewing thing.
How old were you when you first did your first marathon? Let's see. I have to go back 36 years.
That's just ahead on Only a Game from NPR.
This podcast is made possible by Samuel Adams. For 34 years, Samuel Adams has made their Boston Lager inefficiently. Sam Adams brews with 100% heirloom Mittelfrüh hops, lagering their beer for over a month. The Boston Beer Company, Boston, Mass. Savor the flavor responsibly.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Did you just make that up?
Well, yeah.
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
I'm Craig Calcaterra, and it's time for three stories you should know. This week, USA Gymnastics filed for bankruptcy, and that's where we're going to start. I'm joined by sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby via Skype and by Sports Illustrated's Charlotte Wilder. Welcome back to both of you.
Great to be here.
Hi, great to be here.
Patrick, what's the latest on USA Gymnastics?
Well, this week they filed for bankruptcy. Now, you might be saying, that's great. This organization is already pretty morally bankrupt. Why not make it financially official? And of course, I'm referring to USA Gymnastics overseeing years of doing nothing as former team doctor Larry Nassar sexually abused hundreds of girls and young women. Now, Catherine Carson, who's the organization's new chairwoman, said that this filing might actually hasten claim payments to the more than 300 plaintiffs, including Olympic gymnasts, who are currently suing USA Gymnastics over Nassar's crimes. And she might be right. But what she didn't say is that in the bankruptcy filing, it's also going to end all discovery and depositions in those lawsuits. John Manley, who's one of the lawyers for many of Nassar's victims, says this would be a devastating development in terms of figuring out exactly who knew what and when in the Nassar case. So it's very, 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 very likely that they're still trying to cover their own butts. And that's a huge problem, because one of the best ways to make sure that something like this never happens again is to find out exactly how it happened in the first place and hold every last person responsible in any way accountable for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the bottom line here is sports so often, the interests of business take over the interests of actual people. And I think it's, you know, it's disgusting, as Patrick was saying, you know, finding out what happened and everything that was going on should be so much more important than any financial situation. And unfortunately, in sports, it so often isn't. The women who were so brave and came forward, they deserve only the best and only the truth. And it's alarming if this makes that much harder.
Well, I will agree with that. But before my life in sports began, I had a past life as a litigation attorney. And while we all think of bankruptcy generally as, oh, we're out of money and it's a financial move, it is by far more often a legal move designed to put a full stop on litigation. It's very easy to show yourself as insolvent. It's so easy to get a bankruptcy filing approved by a judge. But what it's really all about is let's stop the bleeding. Let's stop the sunlight from coming in and disinfecting everything that needs to be disinfected. I am fairly certain that that's what's happening here. I find it despicable, just as both of you two do. And unfortunately, I don't know that there's going to be a legal means to do anything about it. I think this stuff is going to get buried. I think survivors and victims will be compensated somehow, but it will be at the expense of understanding exactly what happened and why.
I mean, just as Charlotte said that, you know, this is another example of putting profits over people, which, by the way, we all accept with just sort of a shrug, as if it's just normal and okay and good that American corporations are essentially sociopathic. And we should probably think about that a little more. I think it is also another wider example of what you're talking about, Craig. Like, stuff always gets covered up. Powerful tend to get away with stuff. I mean, we don't have to look very far outside of USA Gymnastics and Larry Nassar to see lots of examples of this same phenomenon going on and sort of the use and abuse of the law to make it possible.
Well, on a much lighter note, a few baseball teams are utterly destroying themselves right now. The Arizona Diamondbacks traded away six-time All-Star Paul Goldschmidt this past week. Just before that, the Seattle Mariners traded away second baseman Robinson Cano and their ace closer Edwin Diaz to the New York Mets. They are just the latest of several Major League Baseball teams who are tanking. they decided that, sorry, the perfect is the enemy of the good. We're going to get rid of all of our talent, start from scratch, and probably spend about 3 seasons losing 100 games or thereabouts, just because we want to get better in the future. There's a defense of that. You can look at the Houston Astros. You could look at the Chicago Cubs, recent World Series winners who did very similar things a few years back. But at what cost are these tank jobs coming? We're going to have fans in Seattle, fans in Arizona, fans in any number of places. Really, half the American League is tanking right now, who know that their baseball teams have no intention of competing for a good season, maybe three.
You know, I think that it kind of depends what kind of fan you are, how you think about this. You know, if you're willing to ride it out and get a lot of seasons of greatness. I mean, the Astros were right back in the hunt this year. So, yeah, they had 4 years that were horrendous, but it works. And I think as long as it works, again, you know, from a business perspective, you know, making fans happy, eventually there's something to it. And it's really hard to dissuade GMs from doing that when they see the success. Now, I don't love it, but I think it's hard to argue against it when financially and sort of glory-wise, eventually it does work.
Patrick, do the ends justify the means here?
Well, the problem's the means. I don't even want to talk about the ends. The problem's 100% the means, because you're rewarded for failing by getting higher draft picks. Your higher draft picks are cost-controlled by these ridiculous, you know, rookie contracts and all these sort of shenanigans these teams pull to extend it even longer. These teams have created this artificial sort of life cycle of stinking, being good, tearing it down, and starting over. But even more than that, just off the field, I think a lot of this is the result of the fact that, like, it's pretty much impossible to lose money owning one of these teams. Like, there's so much TV money in the sport now. There's revenue sharing. There's all these mechanisms in place that you don't have to worry about, like, having a good team in order to still have a business. So basically, I think tanking is probably here to stay if you're a fan. You know, it's one of those things where it's like, I'll check back with you in 4 years.
I will say, even though I'm very much and quite transparently against baseball teams tanking and not trying at least to win a little bit, there is a certain segment of fandom that does like this. There used to be a thing where you were a kid and you wanted to be the center fielder for the New York Giants. Well, now you are a kid, you want to be the general manager of the Houston Astros or somebody like that, and you run your fantasy leagues and you run simulations and you get to learn everything about the 17th player on the minor league depth chart or prospect list. And there is an interesting part of the game for fans who are into that stuff. But as I get older, I just prefer a beer and a hot dog and a good baseball game, and we're getting way fewer of those these days.
Yeah, I don't think cheering and rooting for, you know, just asset management is all that interesting. I have to agree with you there.
Charlotte, we are definitely not tanking here. We are turning it over to you, our heavy hitter here, to close this one out.
That's very kind of you. I want to talk about this week some things that Kevin Durant said. Now, Kevin Durant, you know, one of the stars of the Warriors, which is, you know, like the Death Star stacked with stars, was asked for a piece that ran in Bleacher Report about whether players want to play with LeBron or not. And first of all, he said that a lot of young players are made to change their game when they if they want to be in the court with LeBron, just sort of rework things to fit into his plan. He then said, so much hype comes from being around LeBron from other people. He has so many fanboys in the media. Even the beat writers just fawn over him. What was so interesting to me about what Durant said about the media is I think it sort of fed the narrative of Durant needing enemies. You know, he'd famously created Twitter accounts that were burners where no one knew it was him, and he would argue with people who were saying bad things about him online. And he and Russell Westbrook had this falling out. And, you know, the pettiness in the NBA is a big thing these days. And Durant always sort of seems to be at the center of it. And so it's interesting. It's very meta that he sort of keeps doing this as we keep talking about it. And it just goes around and around and around.
Well, I mean, first of all, I love Kevin Durant being like sensitive and cranky all the
yeah.
time or a lot of the
it's
time.
So
it's
good.
Just fun. You know, also, I think as a society and a culture, we're just more gossipy, and maybe we were always gossipy, but now we just have this like, access to do more gossiping. But you know, everything is essentially the Real Housewives now, and it's all kind of the same phenomenon of like, I think we're all just kind of starved for some drama and something to talk about until the next thing comes along.
I think we're being all too meta and all too media navel-gazy with all of this. I'm going to grab my metaphorical beer again and be a sports fan, and I'm going to say, let's look at the content here. He's LeBron James. I don't care if you have to change your game to play with LeBron James. He's the best player in basketball, probably the best player there's ever been in basketball. So on the substance, he's just wrong, and or am I just crazy, Charlotte?
Well, I don't know. You know, there is something interesting to it about what do you give up of your own game and how long do you give that up for? I guess the last thing I'll say is my favorite part about what Durant said was that it just ended up kind of sounding a little sad and jealous. It sounded like he wants fanboys in the media because, like, no one feels about Kevin Durant the way they do about LeBron James. And so there was something kind of delightful. It's like that girl gets all the guys. Like, I don't even want guys. I don't like guys. Don't give me any guys. And it's like, well, I think you kind of want some guys, my friend. It might be Real Housewives, but, man, I'm having a great time.
Well, maybe Kevin Durant can just create a few media fanboys of his own with his Twitter account habits. We'll see. I don't know.
Yeah, I think he did. I think he's done that, Craig.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been sports writer and editor Patrick Ruby and Sports Illustrated Charlotte Wilder. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure, Craig.
Training for a marathon is hard work, so why do it? That was the question on the minds of a hard-hitting group of investigative journalists who gathered in an elementary school classroom in mid-October. We'll start with the subject of their investigation, librarian Jillian Lazaridis.
I hope you're all sitting down. I'm very old. I'm 73. I run 5 days a week, usually. I live near Central Park. I run in Central Park. And it's just wonderful. You have squirrels, you have birds, you have people.
How many marathons have you done? Not just like here, but around the world.
I would say it's about 50. I was born in Europe, Greece. It was near the Yugoslav border. When I was 9 and a half, we got on a ship and we went through the Suez Canal all the way to Australia. We came in at night. And just imagine, and I lived in a little village where there was no electricity, no running water. And then as we're coming by, I see all these twinkling lights. That was Melbourne. If you had never seen lights and you saw them, what would you think they were?
Stars?
Yeah.
Candles?
Candles? Yeah. What else? What do you think you could?
Fireflies?
Fireflies, yeah. Oh, yeah. I thought it was fairyland. I thought that we had come from my little, tiny little village where once the sun set, that was it. You had to walk around with a candle. We got off the next morning and from the porthole we could see our relatives waiting for us. Ah, you bring back happy memories for me. From Australia, I went to London. From London, I flew to New York. So I've been here since 1974.
How old were you when you first did your first marathon?
Oh, wow. Let's see. I have to go back 36 years. I was in my 30s. So that was a long time ago. I was working at this office and my colleague, the other secretary, was a runner. She was an amazing runner. She used to win races, not me. Well, you know, so-so. But Denise Kelly was her name, and she inspired me. She said to me one day, would you like to come for a run? I went, for a run? I can't run. She's all you need is shorts and t-shirt and a pair of running shoes. So we went out very slowly, and then she was my mentor. So she helped me train for the marathon. We did this 10K, 10 kilometers, 6.2 miles. She said, oh, I'm going to run ahead to see if I can find any of my friends. It's basically, I was so slow, her legs were beginning to cramp. So she just went off to, just to stretch her legs out. So she came back. You know, I didn't realize that she was just running backwards and forwards. So I wouldn't feel bad about being so slow. No way you're going to find friends up ahead of you.
So when you're running marathons, like, do you feel relaxed and happy that you're just doing this, or do you feel like tension and scared that you might not finish it or you might like get hurt or something?
I feel all those things when you're running. I feel happy, I feel ecstatic, I feel afraid. Will I be able to finish the marathon? That is, it is a concern. When you're running a marathon, nobody can run it for you. So it's yourself. And when I run, I play games with myself. For example, 3 miles, I will have a little treat. And then another 3 miles, I'll have another treat. It's like, you know what you do with your dog? Come on. You know, when he doesn't want to move, you give him a biscuit. It's not easy, but life is not easy, right? You know, if you wanted to be a musician, you have to work really, really hard. So, you know, it just makes you very, very strong.
What medal are you wearing?
Okay, right. Would you like to put it on?
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. It's heavy. Cool. It's last year's marathon medal, 2017.
When you run these types of marathons, is there a certain feeling you have? For example, like, do you feel proud or something?
You know, it's hard to explain how you feel when you cross the finish line. It's like, it's as though you could do anything you set your mind to. And I would tell my friends they should run a marathon, one marathon in their lifetime.
That's librarian Jillian Lazaridis. She was interviewed by journalists from Indie Kids, a social justice newspaper for and by kids. The piece was produced by Rachel Bongiorno and Clara Ibarra of the Grandparents Story Lab, an intergenerational storytelling project that connects New York's youngest and oldest generations through podcasts and art. We'll have a link where you can see pictures that kids drew of their encounter at onlyagame.org. When Emily Shea decided to quit her job to pursue a career as a rugby referee, she got some advice from her father.
I remember that my dad said, oh, just be like Tarzan. Like, what?
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR. Only a Game listeners, have you supported your public radio station yet? Now's the time. Go to donate.npr.org/onlyagame, then use the hashtag #YourPublicRadio to share why you support independent journalism. I'm Craig Calcaterra. Next week on Only a Game, a tennis great creates a smashing and lucrative fashion line with the help of a legendary sports writer. But now Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, Craig.
The NHL is coming to the Emerald City. On Tuesday, the NHL announced it's going to expand to Seattle. The new team's going to begin playing in the fall of 2021. That's all fun. But does the NHL team in Seattle fill the void that the Seattle Supersonics leaving in 2008 created?
I think it may, actually. The Supersonics leaving there is one of the great atrocities in the history of modern corporate sports. But Seattle's a terrific town for this sort of thing. And the precedent now, of course, is the Vegas Golden Knights.
Yes.
Who had a wonderful opening season, damn near won the Stanley Cup. Seattle's going to get the same kind of flexibility on personnel that the Golden Knights did. It's not Las Vegas, so it doesn't have that real exotic sense of adventure the way the Knights did. But Seattle's a fine, you know, it is a very enthusiastic place. And if the NHL can go there and show up the NBA, given what the NBA did to Seattle, I'm all in favor of it.
What are the nicknames? What are you going to call the Seattle NHL team?
I'd call them the Supersonics, to be honest with you, just to stick it to people, but I don't think people are going to listen to me.
How about the Pilots?
Or the Hendrixes. If you want to name it after Seattle's favorite son, there we are.
Last week, a video emerged of Kansas City Chiefs running back Kareem Hunt shoving and kicking a woman in a Cleveland hotel. It was a video that's not new. It was taken last February. The Chiefs cut him, but the team and the league remain under fire. Why is that?
Because during the quote-unquote investigation of this assault, the NFL didn't talk to the woman or to Kareem Hunt. It appears to be that they're just trying to shuffle Hunt and this whole episode off stage, which the NFL is not going to be able to do because of its really dismal record in this regard.
And I guess, you know, they didn't even investigate the video because TMZ got it. The NFL didn't get it.
Well, that's right. But, you know, TMZ is a guerrilla journalism group, so I think we can trust them. But the video the video is pretty damn awful.
And it does remind me, this is very similar to the Ray Rice case from 2014, again, where video emerged later and then it became serious for the NFL.
Oh, my God. People can watch this on their phones. We should do something about it now. I mean, that's the way the NFL seems to work in these cases.
At that time, Roger Goodell, 4 years ago, he said this will never happen again. So has the NFL not learned a thing from the Ray Rice case?
Apparently not, although it does appear that at least the teams unofficially are quicker to react to Kareem Hunt. But we'll see.
The college football playoffs, 4 participants were selected last Sunday. We have Clemson, Notre Dame, Oklahoma, and Alabama making what I guess we'll call the little dance. Some grumbling from Georgia Bulldogs fans aside, most people think they got it right. I think they got it right anyway. What do you think?
I would have preferred, honestly, to see Georgia in there instead of Notre Dame. But if you accept the fact that Notre Dame is undefeated and is still Notre Dame, then they got it right.
From the Final Four to the Final 80, there's going to be 40 bowl games. We've got the granddaddy of them all in Pasadena, the Rose Bowl, where the Ohio State University Buckeyes will be playing. And then we've got the Bad Boy Mowers Gasparilla Bowl in Tampa, which I'm sure is important to somebody. But are there too many bowl games?
No, there can never be too many bowl games. I love bowl games. I love the parades that go with them. I love the Chamber of Commerce lunches in places like Shreveport. And I like the fact that a lot of these guys get to play another game, even though they are playing for free and all. The players themselves seem to enjoy playing in a bowl game.
We're not worried about a 6-6 team getting a participation trophy, as it were.
If the 6-6 team wants to play really well against the 7-4 team, let them go do it. Let 1,000 flowers bloom.
Sticking with college football, Urban Meyer, the coach of the Ohio State University football team, announced he is going to retire after the Rose Bowl. He said he's doing it for health reasons, and that's not the first time. That's the basis for which he left Florida several years back. This time, though, he's saying, I believe I will not coach again. Do you believe him?
Yes, for the moment. We will see the next time a giant, important, multi-million dollar coaching job comes open, how quickly Urban Meyer's name is rumored to be part of it. If Alabama comes open, who knows? But there aren't many bigger than Florida and Ohio State. In both places, he was wildly successful.
Well, Meyer said also at his press conference he's worried about his legacy. He actually admitted, most people say they don't care about it, but he said he was concerned about his legacy will be, and part of that was due to his early season suspension for mishandling domestic violence allegations against his former assistant coach. Should Meyer be worried about his legacy?
Yeah, absolutely. That's going to hang around his neck like a dead raccoon for the rest of his life.
Finally, Charlie, fans of the video game Mario Kart, in which you choose a
sports!
Nintendo...
Sports!
Mario Kart is sports. Gaming is sports. That's what my son tells me anyway. But, you know, you choose a character, you race him around these really cool tracks and awesome go-karts. It's coming to Florida next year. Why is this a story?
Unless there is, like, a giant gorilla between these guys and the finish line, I am not interested in this. I'm sorry.
Well, $55 is about what the
game
costs.
These are guys in go-karts. This isn't a gaming thing. This is a real go-kart race based on the Mario Kart. But again, unless there's a giant gorilla and a little guy in overalls dropping barrels at them while they race, I'm not interested in this.
Charlie, the gorilla is who dropped the barrels. You might not know that.
I don't know that. I don't recall that because I was never any good at that game. Now, Asteroids I could play.
At the very least, weren't you glad that you didn't have to dodge banana peels and flying turtle shells and things like that to get to the studio today?
Oh, we used to call that Saturday night. Are you kidding?
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated, and he joins us each week on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Craig.
When I was a kid, I wanted to go to the Olympics when I grew up.
That's Emily Shia.
I remember watching the Olympics and seeing Michelle Kwan and Christy Yamaguchi.
She likes a lot of things.
That's Sushia, Emily's mother. And here's Penshia, her father.
Actually, she was shy at the beginning, and we encouraged her to become strong-minded, self-confident. So we introduced her to all sorts of sports.
Soccer, tennis, volleyball, pole vaulting, skiing.
I wasn't a great skier, and this Olympic dream kind of continued to just transform and pivot as I got older.
But Emily's Olympic dream would change in a way she couldn't have predicted. Here's reporter Sophia Rudin.
During Emily Shea's freshman year at Brown University, she signed up for dozens of clubs, including the rugby team. When Emily's parents came to watch her, they saw players on crutches on the sideline, women slamming into each other, tackling their teammates to the ground as the teams warmed up.
First time it was shocked to me. Yeah. Not just surprise. I say, oh, she lied.
Made it sound better than it was.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And we said, wow, this kind of sports Emily's is playing. So we were kind of scared. It was like, we don't prefer this kind of sports for a girl.
She always played fullback, and so one of the responsibilities of fullback is you're the stopper. You have to make that tackle to stop the other team from scoring.
Emily's brother, Brian.
So the other team's got the ball, they're flying down the field, and Emily was the last line of defense, and she had no fear. She comes in like a wrecking ball and just lays down the most crushing tackle I've ever seen. I was like, that's my little sister!
When Emily started playing, rugby wasn't an Olympic sport. But in October of 2009, Emily's sophomore fall, the International Olympic Committee voted to make rugby an Olympic sport, starting in 2016. Emily's dream transformed again. Now, she thought, she might have a shot to make it to the Olympics as a rugby player. Over spring break of her senior year, Emily and the Brown rugby team traveled to Scotland to compete.
When we came back from Scotland, everybody was on the team bus going back to the campus, and they were texting their family. And I just remember sitting on the bus thinking, like, who can I text? Like, everybody that I want to text, all of my family is right here on this bus. It's the 30 people around me.
After graduation, Emily joined a club team in Boston so that she could keep playing. She still dreamed of going to the Olympics as a rugby player, but she suffered back-to-back concussions, and her doctors told her to take a year off. It became clear that her injuries would end her playing career.
I felt like I almost went through the five stages of grief. At first, I was in denial that I wouldn't play again competitively. And then I felt kind of angry at myself for letting myself get injured, even though that's not really how it works in rugby. And then I started bargaining and thinking, oh, maybe if I do these certain training regimens, like, I won't get injured again.
Emily finally made it to the fifth stage, acceptance.
And part of that was that I was just reading rugby newsletters and rugby websites, and I came across an article written by a referee at the time. What it said to me was, like, you could be a referee and you could go to the Olympics, and I really latched onto that.
So maybe acceptance isn't exactly what Emily found. She found an alternative, a different way to achieve her Olympic dream and be a part of the sport she loved. Emily set a couple of goals. She wanted to be an international referee in 5 years and to ref at the Tokyo Olympics in 2020. She applied for a scholarship through USA Rugby to study at a referee academy in South Africa. South Africa is rugby obsessed. Emily remembers the excitement of seeing rugby on TVs, in bus stops, and grocery stores. During the 8-week-long academy, she reffed over 70 games. And she became close with the other referees. So it was especially painful when she found out how they'd been talking about her behind her back.
Just because I was a woman, and that was pretty tough. Because I felt like what I had done on the field had been speaking for itself. And then just for people to kind of distill it into a conversation about gender and not about my ability, that was a little surprising.
But that didn't stop her. When she came back from South Africa, Emily started reffing as many games as possible while working full-time as a data analyst. It was a balancing act.
I would just train either before work or after work almost every day, and then on the weekends, go out there and ref Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
After months of juggling a job and squeezing in rugby matches every weekend, Emily realized she wasn't developing as a referee as fast as she wanted to.
So I actually left my full-time job. I resigned from it with the purpose of being able to spend more of my time training and learning.
Quitting a stable job with benefits to pursue a life reffing an obscure sport isn't what most parents dream of for their children. Her brother, Brian, again.
A lot of immigrant families in the U.S. are very one-track minded in terms of possible career paths. So you either grow up to become a doctor or you grow up to become a lawyer.
So my parents immigrated from Taiwan, and I was worried what they would think because it's less traditional in an Asian American family to just resign and pursue an athletic dream.
But when she told her parents, the reaction she got wasn't quite what she'd expected.
I remember that my dad said, "Oh, just be like Tarzan." I was like, "What?" And he said, "Be like Tarzan. Don't let go of your current vine until you have the next one." And he just asked me, "What's the next vine you're going to grab onto?" And when I told him, he said, "Yeah, that's fine. Just make sure you grab onto that vine."
We support her. That's what it is. And another thing I told her, I say, if rugby is your dream, while you are young and you have time, you pursue for your dream. So while she's young and she has no burden, she can do anything she wants.
Her parents and brother all pitched in to help with her reffing career.
Rugby doesn't pay the bills. Refereeing certainly doesn't pay the bills. Women's sports and athletics doesn't pay the bills. So we helped her pay the bills because we knew that this dream was just more important than anything else.
Emily moved back home to live with her mom and save on rent. Emily's mom, Sue, cooked most of their meals, and they spent a lot of time together.
I would just pull out my computer while my mom and I were about to eat lunch, and then she would say, "Oh, are we watching rugby?" And I would say, "Yeah, we are." And then she started learning, "Oh, is it sevens rugby? Is it 15s rugby? Who's playing? Is this an international? Is this a film of you?"
She bring me to the rugby, the live team. And then I say, "Okay, then I gradually, I like this sports now."
Yeah, what do you like about it?
Like to watch.
Do you watch without Emily?
Yeah, I watch without Emily. I went to this, YouTube. There is a World Rugby YouTube. Sometimes I just watch myself, and then I will tell Emily, I say, "Oh, there is a rugby in the, rugby channel, YouTube." And then she say, "Oh, she already watch it."
A few years ago, Emily moved to Washington, D.C. to ref rugby full-time. She and her mom no longer sit down for lunch together every day. But watching rugby has become part of how Sue shows her support for Emily's career.
My heart was really happy that this thing that I loved, to think about my mom loving it too, it just made me feel really happy.
And it's not just her mom. Recently, Emily traveled to Hong Kong to ref a tournament. She sent the video of her matches to her dad.
Our family text group had been very silent, and then all of a sudden he just said, "Oh, Emily, I watched all of your matches. That was really cool." And that was really touching to me too, because although my parents might not be the ones who fly around the world or around the country to come and watch me in person, they still come through and support me in the ways that they're able to.
Emily is quickly rising through the ranks of rugby referees. She's reffed all over the world. In August, she was promoted to the National Panel, a group of the top refs in the United States. And she was named as one of 13 refs for the Women's Sevens World Series.
She got promoted to the National Panel. I said, "Yeah!"
That's her dream come true.
I said, "Yeah, it's not a short journey. It's a long journey. She's been sacrificed a lot for herself. And then really, she prepared for a long time. That's why I celebrate. I'm just happy for her."
The refs for the 2020 Olympics haven't been announced yet. But as one of the top rugby sevens referees in the world, Emily has a real chance of making her Olympic dream come true. And if she does make it to Tokyo, her parents plan to be there, cheering her on.
Go ref, go ref.
Yeah, 2020.
That story was from reporter Sophia Rudin. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Waller, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. Special thanks this week to WOSU in Columbus for hosting me today. I'm Craig Calcaterra. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.